Then he stretched out his right hand, laid his palm on that unblemished, walnut-colored shoulder of the small, dead animal. Before him there seemed to be a blank wall, black and higher than anything else in the world, impenetrable, silent, beyond his comprehension. Tentatively he pushed at it, but it would not move. He drew in a deep breath and hurled himself entirely into the struggle. "Live," he said. "Geryon, stop!" "Live," he said again, throwing himself deeper into his effort against that blackness.
"It's too late now, Paul," he heard Mr. Wolf say from somewhere. "He has already committed himself."
"Live," Geryon repeated, and the surge he felt welling up out of him was so vast that it drained him utterly. The glowing walls flickered, and then suddenly rang, as if a bell had been struck somewhere deep inside the mountain. The sound shimmered, filling the air inside the domed chamber with a vibrant ringing. The light in the walls suddenly flared with a searing brightness, and the chamber was as bright as noon. The little body under Geryon's hand quivered, and the colt drew in a deep, shuddering breath. Geryon heard the others gasp as the stick-like little legs began to twitch. The colt inhaled again, and his eyes opened.
"A miracle,"
Mandarallan said in a choked voice.
"Perhaps even more than that," Mr. Wolf replied, his eyes searching Geryon's face.
The colt struggled, his head wobbling weakly on his neck. He pulled his legs under him and began to struggle to his feet. Instinctively, he turned to his mother and tottered toward her to nurse. His coat, which had been a deep, solid brown before Geryon had touched him, was now marked on the shoulder with a single, incandescently white patch exactly the size of the mark on Geryon's palm. Geryon lurched to his feet and stumbled away, pushing past the others. He staggered to the icy spring bubbling in the opening in the wall and splashed water over his head and neck. He knelt before that spring, shaking, breathing hard, for a very long time. Then he felt a tentative, almost shy touch on his elbow. When he warily raised his head, he saw the now steadier colt standing at his side and gazing at him with adoration in its liquid eyes. Chapter 9. The storm blew itself out the next morning, but they stayed in the cave for another day after the wind had died down to allow the mare to recover and the newborn colt to gain a bit more strength. Geryon found the attention of the little animal disturbing. It seemed that no matter where he went in the cave, those soft eyes followed him, and the colt was continually nuzzling at him. The other horses also watched him with a kind of mute respect. All in all, it was a bit embarrassing. On the morning of their departure, they carefully removed all of the traces of their stay in the cave. The cleaning was spontaneous, neither the result of some suggestion or of any discussion, but rather was something in which they all joined without comment.
"The fire's still burning,"
Durnick fretted, looking back into the glowing dome from the doorway as they prepared to leave.
"It will go out by itself after we leave,"
Wolf told him.
"I don't think you could put it out anyway, no matter how hard you tried."
Durnick nodded soberly.
"You're probably right."
"Close the door, Geryon,"
Aunt Paul said, after they had led their horses out onto the ledge outside of the cave. Somewhat self-consciously, Geryon took hold of the edge of the huge iron door and pulled it. Although Barak, with all of his great strength, had tried, without success, to budge the door, it moved easily as soon as Geryon's hand touched it. A single tug was enough to set it swinging gently closed. The two solid edges came together with a great hollow boom, leaving only a thin, nearly invisible line where they met. Mr. Wolf put his hand lightly on the pitted iron, his eyes far away. Then he sighed once, turned and led them back along the ledge the way they had come 2 days before. Once they had rounded the shoulder of the mountain, They remounted and rode on down through the tumbled boulders and patches of rotten ice to the first low bushes and stunted trees a few miles below the pass. Although the wind was still brisk, the sky overhead was blue, and only a few fleecy clouds raced by, appearing strangely close. Geryon rode up to Mr. Wolf and fell in beside him. His mind was filled with confusion by what had happened in the cave, and he desperately needed to get things straightened out.
Grandfather?
Yes, Geryon, the old man answered, rousing himself from his half-doze.
Why did Aunt Paul try to stop me? With the colt, I mean.
Because it was dangerous. Very dangerous.
Why dangerous?
When you try to do something that's impossible, you can pour too much energy into it. And if you keep trying, it can be fatal.
Fatal?
Wolf nodded.
You can drain yourself out completely, and you don't have enough strength left to keep your own heart beating.
I didn't know that.
Geryon was shocked. Wolf ducked as he rode under a low branch.
Obviously.
Don't you keep saying that nothing is impossible?
Within reason, Geryon. Within reason.
They rode on quietly for a few minutes, the sound of their horses' hooves muffled by the thick moss covering the ground under the trees.
Maybe I had better find out more about all of this,
Geryon said finally.
That's not a bad idea. What was it you wanted to know?
Everything, I guess.
Mr. Wolf laughed.
That would take a very long time, I'm afraid.
Geryon's heart sank.
Is it that complicated?
No, actually it's very simple. But simple things are always the hardest to explain.
That doesn't make any sense,
Geryon retorted, a bit irritably.
Oh?
Wolf looked at him with amusement.
Let me ask you a simple question, then. What's 2 and 2?
4,
Geryon replied promptly.
Why?
Geryon floundered for a moment.
It just is,
he answered lamely.
But why?
There isn't any why to it, it just is.
There's a why to everything, Geryon.
All right. Why is 2 and 2 4, then?
I don't know. I thought maybe you might.
They passed a dead snag standing twisted and starkly white against the deep blue sky.
Are we getting anywhere?
Geryon asked, even more confused now.
Actually, I think we have come a very long way,
Wolf replied.
Precisely what was it you wanted to know?
Geryon put it as directly as he knew how.
What is sorcery?
I told you that once already.
The will and the word.
That doesn't really mean anything, you know.
All right, try it this way. Sorcery is doing things with your mind instead of your hands. Most people don't use it because at first it's much easier to do things the other way.
Geryon frowned.
It doesn't seem hard.
That's because the things you have been doing have come out of impulse. You never sat down and thought your way through something. No, you just do it, don't you?
Well, isn't it easier that way? What I mean is, why not just do it and not think about it?
Because spontaneous sorcery is just third-rate magic, completely uncontrolled. Anything can happen if you simply turn the power of your mind loose. It has no morality of its own. The good or the bad of it comes out of you, not out of the sorcery.
You mean when I burned Asherak, it was me and not the sorcery?
Geryon asked, feeling a bit sick at the thought. Mr. Wolf nodded gravely.
It might help if you remember that you were also the one who gave life to the colt. The two things sort of balance out.
Geryon glanced back over his shoulder at the colt, who was frisking along behind him like a puppy.
What you're saying is that it can't be either good or bad.
No,
Wolf corrected.
By itself, it has nothing to do with good or bad. And it won't help you in any way to make up your mind how to use it. You can do anything you want to with it. Almost anything, that is. You can bite the tops off all of the mountains or stick the trees in the ground upside down, or turn all of the clouds green if you feel like it. What you have to decide is whether you should do something, not whether you can.
You said almost anything.
I'm getting to that.
Wolf looked thoughtfully at the low-flying cloud above them, an ordinary-looking old man in a rusty tunic and gray hood looking at the sky.
There's one thing that is absolutely forbidden. You can never destroy anything. Not ever.
Geryon was baffled by that.
I destroyed Asherak, didn't I?
No, you killed him. There is a difference. You set fire to him and he burned to death. To destroy something is to try to uncreate it. That is what is forbidden.
What would happen if I did try?
Your power would turn inward on you, and you would be obliterated in an instant.
Geryon blinked and then suddenly went cold at the thought of how close he had come to crossing that forbidden line in his encounter with Asherak.
How do I tell the difference?
He asked in a hushed voice.
I mean, how do I go about explaining that I only meant to kill someone and not destroy him?
It's not a good area for experimentation, Wolf told him. If you really want to kill somebody, stick your sword in him. Hopefully, you won't have the occasion to do that sort of thing too often.
They stopped at a small brook trickling out of some mossy stones to allow the horses to drink.
You see, Geryon, Wolf explained, the ultimate purpose of the universe is to create things. It won't permit you to come along behind it uncreating all of the things it went to so much trouble to create in the first place. When you kill somebody, all you've really done is alter him a bit. You have changed him from being alive to being dead. He's still there. To uncreate him, you have to will him out of existence entirely. When you feel yourself on the verge of telling something to vanish or go away, or be not, you're getting very close to the point of self-destruction. That's the main reason we have to keep our emotions under control all of the time.
I didn't know that.
You do now. Don't even try to unmake a single pebble.
A pebble?
The universe doesn't make any distinction between a pebble and a man.
The old man looked at him somewhat sternly.
Your aunt has been trying to explain the necessity for keeping yourself under control for several months now, and you have been fighting her every step of the way.
Geryon hung his head.
I didn't know what she was getting at,
he apologized.
That's because you were not listening. It's a great failing of yours, Geryon.
Geryon flushed.
What happened the first time you found out you could, well, do things?
He asked, wanting to change the subject.
It was something silly, Wolf replied. Usually is, the first time.
What was it?
Wolf shrugged.
I wanted to move a big rock. My arms and back were not strong enough, but my mind was. After that, I didn't have any choice but to learn to live with it, because once you unlock it, it is unlocked forever. That's the point where your life changes, and you have to start learning to control yourself.
It always gets back to that, doesn't it?
Always. It's not as difficult as it sounds, really. Look at Mandaralan.
He pointed at the knight, who was riding with Durnik. The two of them were deep in discussion.
Now, Mandaralan's a nice enough fellow, honest, sincere, toweringly noble. But let's be honest. His mind has never been violated by an original thought. Until now. He is learning to control fear, and learning to control it is forcing him to think. Probably for the first time in his whole life. It is painful for him, but he is doing it. If Mandarallan can learn to control fear with that limited brain of his, surely you can learn the same kind of control over the other emotions. After all, you are quite a bit brighter than he is.
Silk, who had been scouting ahead, came riding back to join them.
Belgarath, there is something about a mile in front of us that I think you had better take a look at.
All right, Wolf replied. Think about what I've been saying, Geryon. We will talk more about it later.
Then he and Silk moved off through the trees at a gallop. Geryon pondered what the old man had told him. The one thing that bothered him the most was the crushing responsibility his unwanted talent placed upon him. The colt frisked along beside him, galloping off into the trees from time to time and then rushing back, his little hooves pattering on the damp ground. Frequently he would stop and stare at Geryon, his eyes full of love and trust.
"Oh, stop that,"
Geryon told him. The colt scampered away again. Princess Zenedra moved her horse up until she was beside Geryon.
"What were you and Belgarath talking about?"
Geryon shrugged.
"A lot of things."
There was immediately a hard little tightening around her eyes. In the months that they had known each other, Geryon had learned to catch those minute danger signals. Something warned him that the princess was spoiling for an argument. And with an insight that surprised him, he reasoned out the source of her unspoken belligerence. What had happened in the cave had shaken her badly, and Zenedra did not like to be shaken. To make matters even worse, the princess had made a few coaxing overtures to the colt, obviously wanting to turn the little animal into her personal pet. The colt, however, ignored her completely, fixing all of his attention on Geryon, even to the point of ignoring his own mother unless he was hungry. Zenedra disliked being ignored even more than she disliked being shaken. Glumly, Geryon realized how small were his chances of avoiding a squabble with her.
"I certainly wouldn't want to pry into a private conversation," she said tartly. "Oh, it wasn't private. We were talking about sorcery and how to keep accidents from happening. I don't want to make any more mistakes."
She turned that over in her mind, looking for something offensive in it. His mild answer seemed to irritate her all the more.
"I do not believe in sorcery," she said flatly.
In the light of all that had recently happened, her declaration was patently absurd, and she seemed to realize that as soon as she said it. Her eyes hardened even more. Geryon sighed.
"All right," he said with resignation. "Was there anything in particular you wanted to fight about, or did you just want to start yowling and sort of make it up as we go along?"
"Yowling?"
Her voice went up several octaves.
"Yowling?"
"Screeching, maybe,"
he suggested, as insultingly as possible. As long as the fight was inevitable anyway, he determined to get in a few digs at her before her voice rose to the point where she could no longer hear him.
"Screeching?"
she screeched. The fight lasted for about a quarter of an hour before Barak and Aunt Paul moved forward to separate them. On the whole, it was not very satisfactory. Geryon was a bit preoccupied, too much so to put his heart into the insults he flung at the tiny girl, and Zenedra's irritation robbed her retorts of their usual fine edge. Toward the end, the whole thing had degenerated into a tedious repetition of,
"Spoiled brat,"
"Stupid peasant,"
echoing endlessly back from the surrounding mountains. Mr. Wolf and Silk rode back to join them.
"What was all of that yelling about?"
"The children were playing,"
Aunt Paul replied, with a withering look at Geryon.
"Where's Hetar?"
Silk asked.
"Right behind us," Varak said.
He turned to look back toward the pack horses, but the tall Algar was nowhere to be seen. Barak frowned.
"He was just there. Maybe he stopped for a moment to rest his horse or something."
"Without saying anything?
Oh, that's not like him. And it's not like him to leave the pack horses unattended." "He must have had some good reason,"
Durnick said. I'll go back and look for him.
No, Mr. Wolf told Barak. Wait a few minutes. Let's not get scattered all over these mountains. If anybody goes back, we all go back.
They waited. The wind stirred the branches of the pines around them, making a mournful sighing sound. After several moments, Aunt Paul let out her breath almost explosively.
He's coming.
There was a steely note in her voice.
He's been entertaining himself.
From far back up the trail, Hetar appeared in his black leather clothing, riding easily at a loping canter with his long scalp lock flowing in the wind. He was leading two saddled but riderless horses. As he drew nearer, they could hear him whistling rather tunelessly to himself.
What have you been doing? Barak demanded. There were a couple of Murgos following us,
Hetar replied, as if that explained everything.
You might have asked me to go along,
Barak said, sounding a little injured. Hetar shrugged.
There were only two. They were riding Algar horses, so I took it rather personally.
It seems that you are always finding some reason to take it personally where Murgos are concerned,
Aunt Paul said crisply.
Yes, it does seem to work out that way, doesn't it?
Didn't it occur to you to let us know where you were going?
There were only two. I did not expect to be gone for very long.
She drew in a deep breath, her eyes flashing dangerously.
Let it go, Paul,
Mr. Wolf told her.
But
you're not going to change him, so why excite yourself about it? Besides, it is just as well to discourage pursuit.
The old man turned to Hetar, ignoring the dangerous look Aunt Paul leveled at him.
Were the Murgos some of those who were with Brill?
Hetar shook his head.
No. Brill's Murgos were from the south, and they were riding Murgo horses. These two were northern Murgos.
Is there a visible difference?
Mandarallan asked curiously.
Their armor is slightly different, and the southerners have flatter faces. They are not quite so tall.
Where did they get Algar horses?
They are herd raiders,
Hetar answered bleakly.
Algar horses are valuable in Tol Murgos, and certain Murgos make a practice of creeping down into Algeria on horse-stealing expeditions. We try to discourage that as much as possible.
Oh, these horses aren't in very good shape,
Durnick observed, looking at the two weary-looking animals that Hetar was leading.
They've been ridden hard. Whip cuts all over them.
Hetar nodded grimly.
That is another reason to hate the Murgos.
Did you bury them?
No. I left them, where any other Murgo who might be following can find them. I thought it might help to educate any who come along later.
There are some signs that others have been through here, too. I found the tracks of a dozen or so up ahead, Sulk told them.
It was to be expected, I suppose,
Mr. Wolf commented, scratching at his beard.
Tutchik's got his Grolems out in force. Tar Urgus is probably having the region patrolled. I'm sure they'd like to stop us if they could. I think we should move on down into the vale as fast as possible. Once we are there, we won't be bothered any more. Don't they follow us down into the vale, then?
Durnick asked, looking around nervously.
No. Murgos won't go into the vale. Not for any reason. Aldur's spirit is there, and the Murgos are desperately afraid of him.
How many days to the vale?
4, maybe 5, if we ride hard.
We had better get started then, said Silk.
Chapter 10. The weather, which had seemed on the brink of winter in the high mountains, softened back into autumn as they rode down from the peaks and ridges. The forest in the hills above Maragor had been thick with fir and spruce and heavy undergrowth. On this side, however, the dominant tree was the pine, and the undergrowth was sparse. The air seemed drier, and the hillsides were covered with high yellow grass. They passed through an area where the leaves on the scattered bushes were bright red. Then, as they moved lower, the foliage turned first yellow, then green again. Geryon found this reversal of the seasons strange. It seemed to violate all of his perceptions of the natural order of things. By the time they reached the foothills above the Vale of Aldur, it was late summer again, golden and slightly dusty. Although they frequently saw evidences of the Murgo patrols which were crisscrossing the region, they had no further encounters. After they crossed a certain undefined line, there were no more tracks of Murgo horses. They rode down beside a turbulent stream which plunged over smooth, rounded rocks, frothing and roaring. The stream was one of several forming the headwaters of the Aldur River, a broad flow running through the vast Algerian plain to empty into the Gulf of Kerik, 800 leagues to the northwest. The Vale of Aldur was a valley lying in the embrace of the two mountain ranges which formed the central spine of the continent. It was lush and green, covered with high grass and dotted here and there with huge solitary trees. Deer and wild horses grazed there, as tame as cattle. Skylarks wheeled and dove, filling the air with their song. As the party rode out into the valley, Geryon noticed that the birds seemed to gather wherever Aunt Paul moved, and many of the braver ones even settled on her shoulders, warbling and trilling to her in welcome and adoration.
"I had forgotten about that," Mr. Wolf said to Geryon. "It's going to be difficult to get her attention for the next few days."
"Oh?"
"Every bird in the Vale is going to stop by to visit her. Happens every time we come here. The birds go wild at the sight of her."
Out of the welter of confused bird sound, it seemed to Geryon that faintly, almost like a murmuring whisper, he could hear a chorus of chirping voices repeating, "Polgara, Polgara, Polgara."
"Is it my imagination, or are they actually talking?"
"I'm surprised you haven't heard them before," Wolf replied. "Every bird we've passed for the last 10 leagues has been babbling her name."
"Look at me, Polgara, look at me,"
a swallow seemed to say, hurling himself into a wild series of swooping dives around her head. She smiled gently at him, and he redoubled his efforts.
"I've never heard them talk before."
"They talk to her all the time. Sometimes they go on for hours. That's why she seems a little abstracted sometimes. She's listening to the birds. Your aunt moves through a world filled with conversation."
"I didn't know that."
"Well, not many people do."
The colt, who had been trotting rather sedately along behind Geryon, as they had come down out of the foothills, went wild with delight when he reached the lush grass of the vale. With an amazing burst of speed, he ran out over the meadows. He rolled in the grass, his thin legs flailing. He galloped in long, curving sweeps over the low, rolling hills. He deliberately ran at herds of grazing deer, startling them into flight and then plunging along after them.
"Come back here!"
Geryon shouted at him.
"He won't hear you,"
Hetar said, smiling at the little horse's antics.
"At least he will pretend that he doesn't. He's having too much fun."
"Get back here right now."
Geryon projected the thought a bit more firmly than he had intended. The colt's forelegs stiffened, and he slid to a stop. Then he turned and trotted obediently back to Geryon, his eyes apologetic.
"Bad horse,"
Geryon chided. The colt hung his head.
"Don't scold him," Wolf said. "You were very young once yourself."
Geryon immediately regretted what he had said and reached down to pat the little animal's shoulder.
"It's all right,"
he apologized. The colt looked at him gratefully and began to frisk through the grass again, although staying close. Princess Tenedra had been watching him. She always seemed to be watching him for some reason. She would look at him, her eyes speculative, and a tendril of her coppery hair coiled about one finger, and raised absently to her teeth. It seemed to Geryon that every time he turned around she was watching and nibbling. For some reason he could not quite put his finger on. It made him very nervous.
"If he were mine,
I would not be so cruel to him,
she accused, taking the tip of the curl from between her teeth. Geryon chose not to answer that. As they rode down the valley, they passed three ruined towers, standing some distance apart, and all showing signs of great antiquity. Each of them appeared to have originally been about 60 feet high, though weather and the passage of years had eroded them down considerably. The last of the three looked as if it had been blackened by some intensely hot fire.
Was there some kind of war here, Grandfather?
No, Wolf replied rather sadly. The towers belong to my brothers. That one over there was Belisambar's, and the one near it was Belmikor's. They died a long time ago.
I didn't think sorcerers ever died.
They grew tired. Or maybe they lost hope. They caused themselves no longer to exist.
They killed themselves?
In a manner of speaking, it was a little more complete than that, though.
Geryon did not press it, since the old man appeared to prefer not to go into the details.
What about the other one? The one that's been burned? Whose tower was that?
Belzedar's.
Did you and the other sorcerers burn it after he went over to Torak?
No. He burned it himself. I suppose he thought that was a way to show us that he was no longer a member of our brotherhood. Belzedar always liked dramatic gestures.
Where is your tower?
Farther on down the vale.
Will you show it to me?
If you like.
Does Aunt Paul have her own tower?
No. She stayed with me while she was growing up, and then we went out into the world. We never got around to building her one of her own.
They rode until late afternoon, and stopped for the day beneath an enormous tree which stood alone in the center of a broad meadow. The tree quite literally shaded whole acres. Tenedra sprang out of her saddle and ran toward the beautiful tree, her deep red hair flying behind her.
"It's beautiful!"
she exclaimed, placing her hands with reverent affection on the rough bark. Mr. Wolf shook his head. "Dryads. They grow giddy at the sight of trees."
"I don't recognize it," Durnick said with a slight frown. "It's not an oak."
"Maybe it's some southern species," Barak suggested. "I've never seen one exactly like it myself."
"Oh, he's very old,"
Tenedra said, putting her cheek fondly against the tree trunk.
"And he speaks strangely, but he likes me."
"What kind of tree is he?"
Durnick asked. He was still frowning, his need to classify and categorize frustrated by this huge tree.
"It's the only one of its kind in the world,"
Mr. Wolf told him.
"I don't think we ever named it. It was always just the tree." We used to meet here sometimes.
It doesn't seem to drop any berries or fruit or seeds of any kind,
Durnick observed, examining the ground beneath the spreading branches.
It doesn't need them, Wolf replied. As I told you, it's the only one of its kind. It's always been here. Always will be. It feels no urge to propagate itself.
Durnick seemed worried about it.
I've never heard of a tree with no seeds.
It's a rather special tree, Durnick, Aunt Paul said. It sprouted on the day the world was made. And it will probably stand here for as long as the world exists. It has a purpose other than reproducing itself.
Now what purpose is that?
We don't know, Wolf answered. We only know that it's the oldest living thing in the world. Maybe that's its purpose. Maybe it's here to demonstrate the continuity of life.
Tenedra had removed her shoes and was climbing up into the thick branches, making little sounds of affection and delight.
Is there by any chance a tradition of linking dryads with squirrels?
Silk asked. Mr. Wolf smiled.
If the rest of you can manage without us, Geryon and I have something to attend to.
Aunt Paul looked at him questioningly.
It is time for a little instruction, Paul.
We can manage, Father. Will you be back in time for supper?
Keep it warm for us. Coming, Geryon?
The two of them rode in silence through the green meadows, with the golden afternoon sunlight making the entire vale warm and lovely. Geryon was baffled by Mr. Wolfe's curious change of mood. Always before, there had been sort of an impromptu quality about the old man. He seemed frequently to be making up his life as he went along, relying on chance, his wits, and his power, when necessary, to see him through. Here in the vale, he seemed serene, undisturbed by the chaotic events taking place in the world outside. About 2 miles from the tree stood another tower. It was rather squat and round, and was built of rough stone. Arched windows near the top faced out in the directions of the four winds, but there seemed to be no door.
"You said you'd like to visit my tower?" Wolf said, dismounting. "This is it."
"It isn't ruined like the others."
"I take care of it from time to time. Shall we go up?"
Geryon slid down from his horse.
"Where's the door?"
"Right there."
Wolf pointed at a large stone in the rounded wall. Geryon looked skeptical. Mr. Wolf stepped in front of the stone.
"It's me," he said. "Open."
The surge Geryon felt at the old man's word seemed commonplace, ordinary, a household kind of surge that spoke of something that had been done so often that it was no longer a wonder. The rock turned obediently, revealing a sort of narrow, irregular doorway. Motioning for Geryon to follow, Wolf squeezed through into the dim chamber beyond the door. The tower, Geryon saw, was not a hollow shell as he had expected, but rather was a solid pedestal, pierced only by a stairway winding upward.
"Come along,"
Wolf told him, starting up the worn stone steps.
"You watch that one,"
he said about halfway up, pointing at one of the steps. "The stone is loose."
"Well, then why don't you fix it?"
Geryon asked, stepping up over the loose stone.
"Oh, I've been meaning to, but I just haven't gotten around to it. It's been that way for a long time. I'm so used to it now that I never seem to think of fixing it when I'm here."
The chamber at the top of the tower was round and very cluttered. A thick coat of dust lay over everything. There were several tables in various parts of the room covered with rolls and scraps of parchment, strange-looking implements and models, bits and pieces of rock and glass, and a couple of birds' nests. On one, a curious stick was so wound and twisted and coiled that Geryon's eye could not exactly follow its convolutions. He picked it up and turned it over in his hands, trying to trace it out.
"What is this, Grandfather?"
"That? Oh, it's one of Pulgrim's toys," the old man said absently, staring around at the dusty chamber.
"What's it supposed to do?"
"Keep her quiet, when she was a baby, that is. It's only got one end. She spent 5 years trying to figure it out."
Geryon pulled his eyes off of the fascinating, compelling piece of wood.
"Well, that's a cruel sort of thing to do to a child."
"But I had to do something," Wolf answered. "She had a penetrating voice as a child. Dalaran was a quiet, happy little girl, but your aunt never seemed satisfied."
"Beldaran?"
"Your aunt's twin sister."
The old man's voice trailed off, and he looked sadly out of one of the windows for a few moments. Finally, he sighed and turned back to the round room.
"I suppose I ought to clean this up a bit."
He looked again around at the dust and litter.
"Let me help," Geryon offered.
"Just be careful not to break anything," the old man warned. "Some of those things took me centuries to make."
He began moving around the chamber, picking things up and setting them down again, blowing now and then on them to clear away a bit of the dust. His efforts didn't really seem to be getting anywhere. Finally, he stopped, staring at a low, rough-looking chair with the rail along its back scarred and gashed, as if it had been continually grasped by strong claws.
He sighed again.
What's wrong?
Poledra's chair, Wolf said. My wife. She used to perch there and watch me, sometimes for years on end.
Perch?
She was fond of the shape of the owl.
Oh.
Geryon had somehow never thought of the old man as ever having been married, although he obviously had to have been at some time since Aunt Paul and her twin sister were his daughters. The shadowy wife's affinity for owls, however, explained Aunt Paul's own preference for the shape. The two women, Poledra and Beldaran, were involved rather intimately in his own background, he realized, but quite irrationally he resented them. They had shared a part of the lives of his aunt and his grandfather that he would never, could never know. The old man moved a parchment and picked up a peculiar-looking device with a sighting glass in one end of it.
"I thought I'd lost you,"
he told the device, touching it with a familiar fondness.
"You have been under that parchment all this time."
"What is it?"
Thing I made when I was trying to discover the reason for mountains.
The reason?
Yes, everything has a reason.
Wolf raised the instrument.
You see, what you do is...
He broke off and laid the device back on the table.
It's much too complicated to explain. I am not even sure if I remember exactly how to use it myself. I haven't touched it since before Belzedar came to the Vale. When he arrived, I had to lay my studies aside to train him.
He looked around at the dust and clutter.
This is useless. The dust will just come back anyway.
Were you alone here before Belzedar came?
No, my master was here. That's his tower over there.
Wolf pointed through the north window at a tall, slender stone structure about a mile away.
Was he really here? I mean, not just his spirit.
No, he was really here. That was before the gods departed.
Did you live here always?
No. I came like a thief, looking for something to steal. Well, that's not actually true, I suppose. I was about your age when I came here. I was dying at the time.
Dying?
Freezing to death. I had left the village I was born in the year before, after my mother died, and spent my first winter in the camp of the Godless Ones. They were very old by then.
Godless Ones?
Ulgos. Or rather the ones who decided not to follow Gorum to Prolgu. They stopped having children after that, so they were happy to take me in. I couldn't understand their language at the time, and all their pampering got on my nerves, so I ran away in the spring. I was on my way back the next fall, but I got caught in an early snowstorm, not far from here. I lay down against the side of my master's tower to die. I did not know it was a tower at first, with all that snow swirling around. It just looked like a pile of rock. As I recall, I was feeling rather sorry for myself at the time.
Well, I can imagine.
Geryon shivered at the thought of being alone and dying.
Oh, I was a sniveling bit. Sound disturbed my master. He let me in. Probably more to quiet me than for any other reason. As soon as I got inside, I started looking for things to steal.
But he made you a sorcerer instead?
No. He made me a servant, a slave. I worked for him for 5 years before I even found out who he was. Oh, sometimes I think I hated him, but I had to do what he told me to. I didn't really know why. The last straw came when he told me to move a big rock out of his way. I tried with all my strength, but I couldn't budge it. Finally, I got angry enough to move it with my mind instead of my back. That's what he had been waiting for, of course. After that, we got along better. He changed my name from Gareth to Belgareth,
and he made me his pupil.
And his disciple?
That took a little longer. I had a lot to learn. I was examining the reason that certain stars fell at the time he first called me his disciple. And he was working on a round gray stone he had picked up by the riverbank.
Did you ever discover the reason? That stars fall, I mean.
Yes. It's not all that complicated. It has to do with balance. The world needs a certain weight to keep it turning. When it starts to slow down, a few nearby stars fall. Their weight makes up the difference.
I never thought of that.
Neither did I. Not for quite some time.
The stone you mentioned, was it...
The orb. Just an ordinary rock until my master touched it. Anyway, I learned the secret of the will and the word. Which isn't really that much of a secret, after all. It's there, in all of us. Or did I say that before?
I think so.
Probably so. I tend to repeat myself.
The old man picked up a roll of parchment and glanced at it, then lay it aside again.
Oh, so much that I've started and haven't finished.
Grandfather?
Yes, Geryon.
This thing of ours, how much can you actually do with it?
That depends on your mind, Geryon. The complexity of it lies in the complexity of the mind that puts it to use. Quite obviously, it can't do something that can't be imagined by the mind that focuses it. That was the purpose of our studies, to expand our minds, so that we could use the power more fully.
Everybody's mind is different, though.
Geryon was struggling toward an idea.
Yes?
Wouldn't that mean that this thing...
He shied away from the word power...
Well, what I mean is it different? Sometimes you do things, and other times you have Aunt Paul do them.
Wolf nodded.
It is different, in each one of us. There are certain things we can all do. We can all move things, for example.
Aunt Paul called it trans...
Geryon hesitated, not remembering the word.
Translocation, Wolf supplied. Moving something from one place to another. It is the simplest thing you can do. Usually the thing you do first. And it makes the most noise.
That's what she told me.
Geryon remembered the slave he had jerked from the river at Stithis Tor, the slave who had died.
Palgara can do things that I cannot,
Wolf continued.
Not because she's any stronger than I am, but because she thinks differently than I do. We're not sure how much you can do yet, because we don't know exactly how your mind works. You seem to be able to do certain things quite easily, that I would not even attempt. Maybe it's because you don't realize how difficult they are.
I don't quite understand what you mean.
The old man looked at him.
Perhaps you don't at that. Remember the crazy monk who tried to attack you in that village in northern Tornedra, just after we left Orindia?
Geryon nodded.
You cured his madness. It doesn't sound like much until you realize that in the instant you cured him, you had to understand fully the nature of his insanity. That's an extremely difficult thing, and you did it without even thinking about it. And then, of course, there was the colt.
Geryon glanced down through the window at the little horse friskily running through the field surrounding the tower.
The colt was dead, but you made him start to breathe. In order for you to do that, you had to be able to understand death.
It was just a wall. All I did was reach through it.
There's more to it than that, I think. What you seem to be able to do is to visualize extremely difficult ideas in very simple terms. That's a rare gift. But there are some dangers involved in it that you should be aware of.
Dangers? Such as what?
Don't oversimplify. If a man is dead, for example, he is usually dead for a very good reason,
like a sword through the heart. If you bring him back, he will only die immediately again anyway. As I said before, just because you can do something does not necessarily mean that you should.
Geryon sighed. I'm afraid this is going to take a very long time, Grandfather. I have to learn how to keep myself under control. I have to learn what I can't do, so I don't kill myself trying to do something that's impossible. I have to learn what I can do and what I should do. I wish this had never happened to me.
We all do, sometimes. The decision was not ours to make, though. I have not always liked some of the things I've had to do. Neither has your aunt. However, what we are doing is more important than we are, so we do what is expected of us, like it or not.
What if I just said, no, I won't do it?
You could do that, I suppose. But you won't, will you?
Geryon sighed again. No. I guess not.
The old sorcerer put his arm around the boy's shoulders.
I thought you might see things that way, Belgerian. You are bound to this the same way we all are.
The strange thrill he always felt at the sound of his other secret name ran through Geryon.
Why do you all insist on calling me that?
Belgerian, Wolf said mildly. Think, boy. Think what it means. I haven't been talking to you and telling you stories all of these years just because I like the sound of my own voice.
Geryon turned it over carefully in his mind.
You were Gerath, he mused thoughtfully. But the god Aldur changed your name to Belgerath. Zadar was Zadar first and then Belzadar. And then he went back to being Zadar again.
And in my old tribe, Polgara would have just been Gara. Paul is like Bel. The only difference is that she's a woman. Her name comes from mine because she's my daughter. Your name comes from mine, too.
Geryon? Gerath, the boy said. Belgerath. Belgerian. It all fits together, doesn't it?
Naturally, the old man replied. I'm glad you noticed it.
Geryon grinned at him, and then a thought occurred.
But I'm not really Belgerian yet, am I?
Not entirely. You still have a way to go.
I suppose I had better get started, then,
Geryon said with a certain ruefulness, since I don't really have any choice.
Somehow I knew that eventually you'd come around, Mr. Wolf said.
Don't you sometimes wish that I was just Geryon again, and you were that old storyteller coming to visit Faldor's farm, with Aunt Paul making supper in the kitchen as she did in the old days, and we were hiding under a haystack with a bottle I'd stolen for you?
Geryon felt homesickness welling up in him.
Yes. Sometimes, Geryon. Sometimes,
Wolf admitted, his eyes far away.
We won't ever be able to go back there again, will we?
Not the same way, no.
I'll be Belgerian and you'll be Belgerath. We won't even be the same people anymore.
Everything changes, Geryon.
Show me the rock,
Geryon said suddenly.
Which rock?
The one Aldur made you move, the day you first discovered the power.
Oh, that rock. It's right over there, the white one. The one the colt is sharpening his hooves on.
It's a very big rock.
I'm glad you appreciate that, Belgerath replied modestly. I thought so myself.
Do you suppose that I could move it?
You never know until you try, Geryon, Belgerath told him.
Chapter 11 The next morning, when Geryon awoke, he knew immediately that he was not alone.
Where have you been?
He asked silently.
I've been watching,
the other consciousness in his mind said. I see that you have finally come around.
What choice did I have?
None.
You'd better get up.
Haldur is coming. Geryon quickly rolled out of his blankets.
Here? Are you sure?
The voice in his mind did not answer. Geryon put on a clean tunic and hose and wiped off his half-boots with a certain amount of care. Then he went out of the tent he shared with Silk and Durnik. The sun was just coming up over the high mountains to the east, and the line between sunlight and shadow moved with a stately ponderousness across the dewy grass of the vale. Aunt Paul and Belgarath stood near the small fire, where a pot was just beginning to bubble. They were talking quietly, and Geryon joined them.
"You are up early,"
Aunt Paul said. She reached out and smoothed his hair.
"I was awake,"
he replied. He looked around, wondering from which direction Aldur would come.
"Your grandfather tells me that the two of you had a very long talk yesterday."
Geryon nodded.
"I understand a few things a little better now. I'm sorry I've been so difficult."
She drew him to her and put her arms around him.
"It's all right, dear. You had some hard decisions to make." "You're not angry with me, then?" "Oh, of course not, dear."
The others had begun to get up, coming out of their tents, yawning and stretching and rumpled-looking.
"What do we do today?"
Silk asked, coming to the fire and rubbing the sleep from his eyes.
"We wait," Belgarath told him. "My master said he would meet us here."
"I'm curious to see him. I've never met a god before."
"The curiosity, methinks, will soon be satisfied, Prince Skeldar. Look there," Mandarallan said, pointing.
Coming across the meadow, not far from the great tree beneath which they had pitched their tents, a figure in a blue robe was approaching. A soft nimbus of blue light surrounded the figure, and the immediate sense of presence made it instantly clear that what approached was not a man. Geryon was not prepared for the impact of that presence. His meeting with the spirit of Issa in Queen Salmisra's throne room had been clouded by the narcotic effects of the things the Serpent Queen had forced him to drink. Similarly, half of his mind had slept during the confrontation with Mara and the ruins of Mar Amon. But now, fully awake in the first light of morning, he found himself in the presence of a god. Aldor's face was kindly and enormously wise. His long hair and beard were white, from conscious choice. Geryon felt rather than from any result of age. The face was very familiar to him somehow. It bore a startling resemblance to Belgarath's, but Geryon perceived immediately with a sudden curious inversion of his original notion that it was Belgarath who resembled Aldur. As if their centuries of association had stamped Aldur's features upon the face of the old man. There were differences, of course. That certain mischievous roguishness was not present on the calm face of Aldur. That quality was Belgarath's own, the last remnant, perhaps, of the face of the thieving boy Aldur had taken into his tower on a snowy day some 7,000 years ago.
"Master," Belgarath said, bowing respectfully, as Aldur approached.
"Belgarath,"
the god acknowledged.
His voice was very quiet.
"I have not seen thee in some time. The years have not been unkind to thee."
Belgarath shrugged wryly.
"Some days I feel them more than others, master. I carry a great number of years with me."
Aldur smiled and turned to Aunt Paul.
"My beloved daughter,"
he said fondly, reaching out to touch the white lock at her brow.
"Thou art as lovely as ever."
"And thou as kind, master,"
she replied, smiling and inclining her head. There passed among the three of them a kind of intensely personal linkage, a joining of minds that marked their reunion. Geryon could feel the edges of it with his own mind, and he was somewhat wistful at being excluded, though he realized at once there was no intent to exclude him. They were merely re-establishing an eons-old companionship, shared experiences that stretched back into antiquity. Aldur then turned to look at the others.
"And so, you have come together at last.
as it has been foretold from the beginning of days that you should. You are the instruments of destiny, and my blessing goes with each as you move toward that awful day when the universe will become one again."
The faces of Geryon's companions were awed and puzzled by Aldor's enigmatic blessing. Each, however, bowed with profound respect and humility. And then, Zenedra emerged from the tent she shared with Aunt Paul. The tiny girl stretched luxuriantly and ran her fingers through the tumbled mass of her flaming hair. She was dressed in a dryad tunic and sandals. "Zenedra?" Aunt Paul called her. "Come here."
"Yes, Lady Polgara,"
the little princess replied obediently. She crossed to the fire, her feet seeming barely to touch the ground. Then she saw Aldor standing with the others and stopped, her eyes wide.
"This is our master, Zenedra. He wanted to meet you."
The princess stared at the glowing presence in confusion. Nothing in her life had prepared her for such a meeting. She lowered her eyelashes and then looked up shyly, her tiny face artfully and automatically assuming its most appealing expression. Aldor smiled gently.
"She's like a flower that charms without knowing it."
His eyes looked deeply into those of the princess.
"There is steel in this one, however. She is fit for her task. My blessings upon thee, my child."
Zenedra responded with an instinctively graceful curtsy. It was the first time Geryon had ever seen her bow to anyone. Aldor turned then to look full at Geryon. A brief, unspoken acknowledgment passed between the god and the consciousness that shared Geryon's thoughts. There was in that momentary meeting a sense of mutual respect and of shared responsibility. And then, Geryon felt the massive touch of Aldor's mind upon his own, and knew that the god had instantly seen and understood his every thought and feeling.
"Hail, Belgerion," Aldor said gravely.
"Master,"
Geryon replied. He dropped to one knee, not really knowing why.
"We have awaited thy coming since time's beginning. Thou art the vessel of all our hopes."
Aldor raised his hand.
"My blessing, Belgerion. I am well pleased with thee."
Geryon's entire being was suffused with love and gratitude as the warmth of Aldor's benediction filled him.
"Dear Polgara," Aldor said to Aunt Paul, "thy gift to us is beyond value. Belgerion has come at last, and the world trembles at his coming."
Aunt Paul bowed again.
"Let us now go apart," Aldor said to Belgarath and Aunt Paul. "Your task is well begun, and I must now provide you with that instruction I promised when first I set your steps upon this path. That which once clouded becomes clearer, and we now can see what lies before us. Let us look toward that day that we have all awaited, and make our preparations."
The three of them moved away from the fire, and it seemed to Geryon that as they went, the glowing nimbus which had surrounded Aldor now enclosed Aunt Paul and his grandfather as well. Some movement or sound distracted his eye for a moment, and when he looked back, the three of them had vanished.
Barak let out his breath explosively. "Belor, but that was something to see."
"We have been favored, I think, beyond all men," Mandarallan said.
They all stood staring at each other, caught up in the wonder of what they had just witnessed. Zenedra, however, broke the mood.
"All right,"
she ordered peremptorily.
"Don't just stand there gaping. Move away from the fire."
"What are you going to do?"
"The Lady Polgara is going to be busy,"
the little girl said loftily.
"So I am going to make the breakfast."
She moved toward the fire with a businesslike bustling. The bacon was not too badly burned, But Senedra's attempt to toast slices of bread before the open fire turned out disastrously. And her porridge had lumps in it as solid as clods in a sun-baked field. Garion and the others, however, ate what she offered without comment, prudently avoiding the direct gaze she leveled at them, as if daring them to speak so much as one word of criticism.
"I wonder how long that they are going to be," Silk said after breakfast.
"Gods, I think, have little notion of time," Barak replied sagely, stroking at his beard. "I don't expect them back until sometime this afternoon at the earliest."
"It is a good time to check over the horses," Hetar decided. "Some of them have picked up a few burrs along the way, and I would like to have a look at their hooves, just to be on the safe side."
"I'll help you," Dernick offered, getting up.
Hetar nodded, and the two of them went off to the place where the horses were picketed.
"And I've got a nick or two in my sword edge," Barak remembered, fishing a piece of polishing stone out of his belt and laying his heavy blade across his lap.
Mandarallan went to his tent and brought out his armor. He laid it out on the ground and began a minute inspection for dents and spots of rust. Silk rattled a pair of dice hopefully in one hand, looking inquiringly at Barak.
"If it's all the same to you, I think that I would like to enjoy the company of my money for a while longer," the big man told him.
"Oh, this whole place absolutely reeks of domesticity," Silk complained.
Then he sighed, put away his dice, and went to fetch a needle and thread and tunic that he had torn on a bush up in the mountains. Senedra had returned to her communion with the vast tree, and was scampering among the branches, taking what Garion felt to be an inordinate risk as she jumped from limb to limb with a cat-like unconcern. After watching her for a few moments, he fell into a kind of reverie, thinking back to the awesome meeting that morning. He had met the gods Asa and Mara already, but there was something special about Aldur. The affinity Belgarath and Aunt Paul showed so obviously for this god, who had always remained aloof from men, spoke loudly to Garion. The devotional activities of Sindaria, where he had been raised, were inclusive rather than exclusive. A good Sindar prayed impartially and honored all of the gods, even Torak. Garion now, however, felt a special closeness and reverence for Aldur, and the adjustment in his theological thinking required a certain amount of thought. A twig dropped out of the tree onto his head, and he glanced up with annoyance. Senedra, grinning impishly, was directly over his head.
"Boy,"
she said in her most superior and insulting tone,
"the breakfast dishes are getting cold. The grease is going to be difficult to wash off if you let it harden."
"I'm not your scullion," he told her.
"Wash the dishes, Garion,"
she ordered him, nibbling at the tip of a lock of hair.
"Wash them yourself."
She glared down at him, biting rather savagely at the unoffending lock.
"Why do you keep chewing on your hair like that?" "What are you talking about?"
she demanded, removing the lock from between her teeth.
"Every time I look at you, you've got your hair stuck in your mouth." "I do not,"
she retorted indignantly.
"Are you going to wash those dishes?"
"No," he squinted up at her. The short dryad tunic she was wearing seemed to expose an unseemly amount of leg.
"Why don't you go put on some clothes?" he suggested. "Some of us don't appreciate the way you run around half-naked all of the time."
The fight got underway almost immediately after that. Finally, Garion gave up his efforts to get in the last word and stomped away with disgust.
"Garion,"
she screamed after him,
"don't you dare go off and leave me with all of these dirty dishes."
He ignored her and kept walking.